I grew up during a time when camouflage meant leftover military stuff, like the Vietnam-era tiger stripe camo or the good old reliable woodland camo. That started to change during my junior high years when Jim Crumley patented his now famous tree bark camo and Bill Jordan wasn't far behind with Realtree. During my sophomore year of college, I was checking traps on my coyote line when a fellow emerged from some heavy hardwood timber. He was wearing a pattern I came to find out later was called Skyline, which is nothing like the Skyline that's available today. I honestly didn't see the guy until he was nearly beside me. It was astonishing how well he blended with the timber. A really good camo, augmented by patience and slow movement, can do that. It can render you just almost invisible in a hunting situation. The trick, though, is to match your camo to the terrain you will be hunting. Today there are an almost unlimited number of camo choices, and some are very specific to certain terrains, and not nearly as effective in others. What got me to thinking about this was a classroom visit I made to a preschool at the Dillingham Head Start the other day. I was trying to get them to understand just what camouflage meant, which is blending in. Of course, the lesson I went over with them was tied to some of our area's crafty critters that are very adept at blending in, or should be. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Education Specialist for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. During my Head Start visit, hello, Mrs. Whittington's class. I tried to share some very basic information. After all, it was a preschool class. Really, the lesson consisted of just a few basic things. First, I tried to convey that camouflage means blending in with the environment. Next, I shared photos of various animals from around the Togiak Refuge area. Some are able to blend in through the simple fact that they're drab-colored and tend to live in areas where such colors do blend well, especially when combined with slow, deliberate movements. This can be virtually any type of animal, be it bird or mammal, that's predominantly browns and grays. There are other animals, though, that take it a step further, having the ability to change colors with the seasons. It is those species I'd like to focus on today. I think I have shared on here before that mere months after moving to Alaska a lifetime ago, I was 25 at the time, I had a chance to go snow machining with a guy that would go on to become one of my best friends. If you're listening and connected to New Halen in any way and know Michael Trefon, tell him I said hey. It was January and a real winter that year, and Michael hauled my Alaska uneducated butt up into the mountains one Saturday afternoon. I remember him commenting about how the mountains were covered in birds. I strained to see what he was looking at but could see nothing, which bugged me because I usually have pretty keen eyesight where wild game is concerned. It wasn't until we went tearing through some alders and the air exploded with white birds that I finally saw what he had seen from a distance. The whiteness of the ptarmigan was a very effective camouflage indeed. For the sake of today's episode, let's consider those species found on the refuge that are able to go white when winter gets here. The collared lemming, snowshoe hare, tundra hare, ermine, least weasel, arctic fox, and ptarmigan. Have you ever wondered just how it is that they go all white, or mostly white anyway, in the first place? What exactly triggers the change? How does it happen? The answer to what triggers it is called photoperiodism. Photoperiodism is a physiological change in plants and animals that's tied to seasonal changes in the length of the day, something that's a bit more pronounced up here than it is in other places. The length of the day and a knowledge of the seasons are critical to most animal species. A number of biological and behavioral changes are dependent on this, including migrations, hibernations, sexual behavior, and what we're talking about today, fur and feather color. In case you're curious about how we know it's tied to the length of daylight, consider a couple of things. First, scientists have been able to duplicate indoors what Mother Nature does outdoors, specifically with hares, by controlling the amount of light and documenting coat color and changes. Also, differences in the same species can be seen in different geographic locations based on the length of days. For example, snowshoe hares in the far north stay white longer through a year than snowshoe hares in more southern places. Why it happens is another matter. Sure, the camouflage is advantageous, but not all species associated with the north or cold or snow change colors, while some stay white all the time. For example, polar bears and snowy owls are always white, While scientists are unsure why that's the case, one theory is that a pale coat may have better insulating properties. Melanin, the substance responsible for colored hair, is absent from the white fur of species that turn white. The lack of melanin leaves air space in the air shaft, which traps heat. So that's a possibility beyond the camouflage aspect. Let's start with Arctic foxes. These small canines really aren't very common to our area. We're kind of actually beyond the southern end of the range of where you could expect to see them. They are listed in the Togiak Wildlife Species list, but they're far from common, and they'd be absolute fools to hang around here this year, given our lack of snow. No, it's far more likely that if you see a fox here, it's going to contrast with our winter backgrounds and be a nice vibrant orangish red. The smallest species to sport white in the winter is the northern collared lemming, a short, stocky rodent. It is the only member of the rodent family that does turn completely white in the winter. They also develop seriously long claws on their front feet in the winter to aid in breaking through snow and ice. Think camouflage, with built-in snow shovels, and you've got a wintertime collared lemming. When I say small, they average 4 to 5 inches in length and weigh under a pound. As with other small rodents, they are not normally long for this world, with wild lemmings lasting a year if they're lucky. But also like other rodents, Mother Nature has them configured to replenish just as quickly, with females giving birth up to 3 times a year, with 5 or more young per litter. There are 2 species of hares in Alaska, both of which turn white in the winter, and both of which can be found around Bristol Bay. The chief differences are ones of location and size. Snowshoe hares are the more common and widespread. They are found all over the state except in the lower Kuskokwim Delta, the Alaska Peninsula, and north of the Brooks Range. Tundra hares are more of a West Coast thing and can be found on the peninsula and north of the Brooks Range. Also, snowshoe hares are found in mixed spruced forests, wooded swamps, and brushy areas, whereas tundra hares normally are found on rocky slopes and upland tundra. With regards to the size, it's actually a pretty decent difference. Snowshoe hares are about 20 inches long, or a little less, and weigh 3 to 4 pounds. Tundra hares can push 30 inches in length and weigh 8 to 12 pounds. And then there are the weasels, specifically the least weasel and the short-tailed weasel, frequently called the ermine. In the summer, both are medium to dark brown, but in the winter, both turn white. Ermine are the larger of the two, sometimes reaching a length of 15 inches and weighing nearly a half pound. The least weasel is the smallest living carnivore. They are roughly 2/3 the length of an ermine and weigh about 3 ounces. An ermine's tail is always tipped black, whether winter or summer. The tail of a least weasel has only a few black hairs in the tip. Both are voracious predators, feeding primarily on small rodents. They eat as much as 40% of their body weight each day, and because their world is such a feast or famine proposition, when they find an abundance of mice or lemmings or other small rodents, they'll kill as many as they can and store what they can't eat. The final turns white species is the ptarmigan. Actually, there are 3 species of ptarmigan in Alaska. Officially, all 3 can be found on the refuge. The reality is, though, that the overwhelming number of ptarmigan you'll see will be willow ptarmigan. There are small differences between them. The white-tailed ptarmigan, by virtue of the fact that its tail is always white, turns completely white in the winter. The other 2, even in the winter, will retain a few black tail feathers. An interesting side note about ptarmigan in the winter is that not only do they add camo to their winter arsenal, but they also grow snowshoes. They grow dense, white feathers on both the tops and bottoms of their feet, and their claws grow longer. Snowshoes, as it were, which provides them with better footing on the snow. I have some winter camo of my own, though mine comes off shortly after I walk in the door. I'm not sure how much it helps me to stay warm, but I am convinced it helps me to get closer to other winter critters when I'm out there. Whether you have winter camo or not, I'd strongly encourage you to get outside to try and see some of the winter animals we have around the area that have that knack for blending in with the winter terrain. This year, it might not even be that much of a trick to pull that off. For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.